Professor John Dominic Crossan, the great Jesus scholar of this generation, whose books I love to read, wrote a very provocative book lately called How to Read the Bible and Still Believe in God, a very provocative title. In it he writes, I compare and contrast the programs of John the Baptist and Jesus with no intention of exalting the latter over the former or vice versa. I'm convinced that Jesus learned tremendously from John and that he eventually changed his own vision because of what happened to his mentor. Later, when he came to disagree with John, Jesus was still very careful not to disrespect him. Furthermore, it was probably the abiding popularity of John that protected Jesus from King Herod Antipas in Galilee. That fox would have calculated carefully how long before he could execute another popular prophet. Now, we know about Herod Antipas, the king, proverbial rich kid, pampered son of entitlement, raised by a shady character of a father, out of touch with the common folk and their troubles, lustful in his personal desires, cruel and heartless in his judgments, he ruled by decree. We live with that every day in politics, friends. If he were alive today, Herod Antipas would tweet every morning from the bathroom. But what of John the Baptist? Is John the Baptist a comforter? We know Herod Antipas is no comforter. Is John the Baptist a comforter, or is he a challenge, do you think? The second Sunday of Advent is traditionally the Sunday of John the Baptist, the forerunner, as he is called. And the John the Baptist of history is very different from the John the Baptist portrayed in the Gospels. John the Baptist in history was widely known in his day. He was the person of interest in ancient Galilee. Jesus of Nazareth was not. He had his own literary tradition. People wrote down and remembered what John the Baptist said. He had his own set of communities that grew up around him and followed his teachings. His words and influence lasted in the region far beyond his own death. John, indeed, was a prophetic figure to whom young Jesus went as a disciple. It says in the Gospels that Jesus remained 40 days in the wilderness to be tempted. The word means tested, to be tested by the devil. It's interesting to think that this is a romanticized version written later of Jesus' time spent in the wilderness in the community of John the Baptist learning the ropes of the mission. Both John and Jesus, and this may be a surprise, both John and Jesus were intent on breaking the hold of Roman occupation in Judea. That was their mission, to break the hold of Roman occupation in Judea. So Christianity began as a political movement, not as a world religion. It was a political movement, rebels with a cause. It would have been recognized today among ISIS or the Taliban, the same kind of mentality working against the invasive and pervading empire, the same mentality. But over the centuries, imperial adoption and layers of custom have piled on by the power elite, have changed this political push into a religion of salvation. It doesn't cost the political powers anything to support it, as long as people are down on their hands and knees, praying to the great God for salvation and not making any changes in the way the culture functions. But in John's day and in Jesus' day as a follower, these small groups of intentional people would meet, some of them separately, in wilderness places, private places, where they could be together unharassed by the authorities. the Essene community from which the Dead Sea Scrolls came would have been such a group, and others would meet intentionally in villages and towns and cities, keeping their own company, going about their business every day, working in the empire and doing their jobs, but in the mornings they would meet together intentionally for breakfast and commit themselves to each other and to the good of the broader community and to the great God revealed in Jesus Christ the Lord. When Pliny the Younger, the Roman, went in report to his emperor, this is what he found Christians to be like and reported it back to the leader. Snippets of John the Baptist's message can still be heard in the Gospels, although the Gospels are written to lift up Jesus and to lay John into a secondary role. The rite of baptism was John's liturgical masterpiece. He would recreate Israel's arrival in the Promised Land and allow the people, the oppressed people, to experience what that felt like. John the Baptist organized an opera, and he himself was the impresario, and the people of the towns and villages who came to him were invited to be part of the cast, part of the chorus, and part of the singers. They would gather in the desert, that was the backdrop, and there together they would experience the songs of wandering and worrying and hungering for leadership. And then at the right moment, John would enter dressed as Elijah the prophet, with a camel hair shirt and a belt around his waist, with handfuls of honey and locusts and eating them and feeding others around him, the great prophetic giver in the midst of a hungry crowd. He became the gold standard of what it looked like to be a faithful person in a time of political oppression, and the people ate it up. He anchored himself intentionally in the wilderness. That was the historic, symbolic setting out of which ancient Israel came into the Promised Land. It was formed by God in that wandering in the wilderness when God became real for the people, and then God led them from the wilderness across the River Jordan into the Promised Land, and John did exactly the same thing. The River Jordan was the crossing point. And they would have been led, as in the old days, by a prophetic voice. In the first instance, it was Joshua, whose name actually translates Jesus. Isn't that interesting? Jesus was the one who led them across the river into the Promised Land, and they would go across the river and find the walled city of Jericho, seen symbolically in the walled city of Roman occupation. It's the same image, the same vision. And the people in the first instance followed the Ark of God, the very presence of God across the river, a tradition they knew quite well. And in this case, John the Baptist washed them in the river of their belonging, sent them across to their own land, not as minions and cowering servants of an empire, but as instruments of a living God entering a land to which they belonged. The crowd would wash itself pure in a ritual of purification, cleansing itself from Gentile influence and creeping cultural infection. And then they would cross together to the Promised Land, holding their heads high and singing the songs of God, terribly threatening to the empire. Apparently, there were lots of John the Baptist types in those days, and the Romans would systematically go to where they met, pick them up, and cart them away. But John somehow managed to survive for a very long time and grew a great crowd. This was a war he was raging. It was a war that Jesus was raging, empowered by this ritual of great theater that the people would recognize deep down inside. Now, John's ethical stances are revealed in the parts of the gospel that still reflect him. With every word he uttered, he was dismantling the power of Roman occupation. He spoke to the tax collectors, that's recorded in the Gospels. The tax collectors were local people, Jews, who would work for the Roman occupiers, and they would collect dreaded Roman taxes from their own people. Now they were hated, they were despised, they were rejected, and the only way you could make a life out of it was by taking more than was allowed. The Roman overlords would turn a blind eye. You could make yourself rich. No one would care. The local people couldn't speak against you, and the Roman authorities would praise you for your labor. And so the tax collectors were a despised and wealthy group. And to them, John the Baptist said, "Take no more than is required by the empire. Treat your own people with respect as a sign of resistance to the empire." Slowly, by doing that, he is dismantling the will of the local leaders to cheat their own people. He is dismantling the will of the local leaders to support the oppression of the visitor. Soldiers were there too, and John warned them in the Gospels to be gentle. Do not abuse your power. Just because you're armed and have the backing of the state and can push people around, these are your people. These are your brothers and your sisters in a strife-filled time. Be gentle with your own people. No bullying, no cruelty in your petty power. And soldiers in this case refer not only to those who worked for the state, perhaps they worked as temple guards, or perhaps they worked for the Roman occupiers, but also terrorists, as we would call them today, groups of armed men who lived in caves and who would raid small villages, much as ISIS or the Taliban would do today. These too were soldiers in a similar war, and to them, John the Baptist said, "Be gentle among your own people. Protect the children of God and use your strength for the glory of the tribe," he said. Now, John the Baptist was a thorn in the side of the state, and we're told in history and in the Gospels that he paid the price for it. Indeed, the story of Salome dancing the dance of the seven veils and of John being beheaded at the whim of the king and so on. These stories are probably created. They circulated, associated with others in the ancient world. They were thought to be symbols of the poor people telling one another how terrible the rich people can do and what they can do to us if given a chance. So the thought that John the Baptist was the victim of a seven-veil dance in the royal court at the whim of a semi-drunken king is probably historically untrue. What is historically true is that John the Baptist was beheaded at Machaerus Castle, a castle on the far edge of the state where no one would see. The king had him secreted away and had his head severed from his body. And the Gospels tell us that immediately after the execution of John, Jesus, his pupil, came preaching. The movement would go on. The rebellion continued. And the message Jesus preached was John's message. "Break away," he said. "Make yourselves clean," he said. "Prepare for God's arrival. Be instruments. Repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand." The same message as John had brought. Later in the Jesus movement, this shifted away from the idea of God's kingdom coming to God's kingdom having already arrived. Indeed, by the time the Gospels were written, it was said by the church that it had arrived in the person of Jesus Christ and his story. So the message shifted. Within two generations, the church had moved to the pattern that we see today and that we still acknowledge as normal today. The idea of John the Baptist being the forerunner to something and Jesus being the superstar. The idea of liberation from political oppression has slipped away into the background. That shift is away from a shared movement against cultural entrenchment and towards a cult of popularity. Let's follow the popular one to see where he can take us. And lots of communities of faith still operate in that model. Never mind the meaning of the movement. Never mind what needs to be done in life for truth and justice and the power of the Spirit of the living God. Let's follow the popular one, the one who has the votes, and see where it can take us in our life. A seemingly secondary way to go. So is John a challenge or a comfort, do you think? Consider the Isaiah passage, which was read so beautifully in the King James Version of the Bible. Do you realize that the King James Version was written intentionally to be read aloud in the churches? I think that's so wonderful. King James had a perception of that. The Gospels and the stories of the Bible were meant to be heard. And so when you buy a King James Bible, you will notice that every line is separated from another by a space, intentionally created by King James the Sixth and First in order that it could be read aloud clearly and was written to be heard by a living audience. You heard the power of it this morning as it was read. Indeed, someone wrote of this Isaiah passage, "The eloquence of this chapter is wholly without parallel in the entire literature of the ancient Oriental world. A poet-prophet in one person uttered them in an ecstasy of joy, in a glow of hope, in a certainty of conviction." Now, Isaiah's poetry was written to a people in captivity, and it underpinned the later message of John and Jesus. This was the message, the Isaiah message, which focused the work of John and Jesus. It is the end of imperial occupation by the inbreaking power of God. "Comfort, comfort my people," says the Lord, "your warfare is over." What a message. Who among us can live without comfort? No wonder the message took root. But the word comfort is complex. It's in the Bible. You knew it would be complex. In Greek and in Hebrew, the word means gather round. It has a meaning that combines encouragement with entreaty with exhortation. The word means pay attention. It means, "I have life-saving news for you," all in the little Greek and Hebrew renderings of the word comfort. And when you get to the Latin word, comfortare, the meaning is even more complex. Strengthen, aid, console, encourage, refresh, renew, soothe. All of these found in the simple word comfort. All of these come into play with the arrival of God. And notice from the Isaiah passage what is being offered to us in this comfort. First, it's a new day. A social and emotional shift will occur to take us from peril to promise. As a culture, we will feel the shift towards promise. Isn't that comforting? There will be a highway for our God. This is an interesting symbol. No one would ever see the high and mighty in the ancient world. Capitals were often far away from each other, but on occasion, the great kings and emperors would go on procession. No one would know they were coming until a week or so later, when forerunners would arrive announcing that the emperor was on the way and would pass through this region. And the builders would come, and they would start to take down the hills and raise the valleys and literally fill a roadway with stones so that the royal chariot of the king and the king's procession could pass easily and without restriction. And as the people waited, the tension and the joy arose. They would actually see the coming of a king. They would see it with their own eyes. They would hear the heralds and the trumpets blazing. And then in a moment of glory, along the road, they would see the royal procession. And in the midst of it, in a golden chariot, the emperor, the one who controlled the whole of the world, "Make straight in the desert a highway for our God," wrote Isaiah. "There will be a true resting place beyond mortal years," says the text. "The flowers fade, the grass fades. We are flowers, we are grass," but there is something in this, something in the spirit of the one who is around us and who is to come, who will sustain us and all things forever. There is comfort for us. There will be clear judgment, finally, of those who are in charge and how it all works. No more fog, no more guessing, no more false news. There will be a clarity on the outside and a perception on the inside and a courage to bring them together and make them work for the good of all. That's comfort. And there will be an intensity of God's nearness. We will finally see the nature of the God we seek. The one who walks among us gently, carrying the young in loving arms and caring for those who are with young, the least, the last, the lost, the vulnerable around us and in us, blessed by the great God. Now, clearly, there are implications for this comfort. There is a response called for. This is not a comfort of feather pillows and sweet dreams somewhere safe and secure. A new world that is breaking in upon an old world is going to break some dishes in the process. So here's what we must do in order to participate in the challenging guise of comfort. Here is what we must do. First, comfort will involve an intensifying of our personal and group discipline. No more social drift, no more surface thinking, no more intentional ambiguity about things. Well, I'm not sure, you're probably right, but I'm not sure that I have to do anything about it in order to protect my living, and so no more of that. No more short-term goals for private payoffs. No more of that. We are not limited to self-seeking, but we are commanded to be servants of the living God, an intensifying of our personal and group discipline in order to receive the comfort. Secondly, comfort demands a different angle of vision. If the inbreaking of God is real, then we must keep on looking for it, to live at the edge of tomorrow and not just in the middle of today. Live at the edge. What's going to happen tomorrow? To look with expectation. What do I need to put aside from today in order to welcome tomorrow, we need to ask. Look for the strangeness of the morning as opposed to the predictability of the evening. Oh, it's always been this way. The systems will never change, we say. Look for the strangeness of the morning and value the emerging links rather than being transfixed by the predictable patterns. These are only my friends, these are only my enemies, and all the rest of it, no, no, no. Be moved by what flows in front of you. There is the comfort in breaking from God. And thirdly, comfort opens a space in the great parade and invites us to join it. Yes, life is a great parade. It is not individual characters that are of prime importance. It is the parade itself. Not John the spark, not Jesus the fire, not Herod the smotherer, not Caesar the cork in the crystal snifter, not the pace of the nation, not the power of the cult. None of these is important. These are just floats in the parade. We are invited to walk among them, to see what we see and feel what we see, what we feel. That's the task. Every year on Canada Day, my family and I go from the cottage along to the little town of Bath, just on Lake Ontario, and we take part in the Bath Canada Day Parade. And they have horses and tractors and farmers and ambulances and all the rest of it. And our children watch the pipe bands and the marching bands, and they buy a hamburger in the park, and they listen to the music of the local musicians. But the favorite part, has to do with water pistols. You knew it would. First of all the fire trucks from the area, new ones and old ones, big ones and small ones, come together in a pack right at the beginning of the parade. And they are, of course, loaded with water pumpers, and the firemen are all dressed ready to shower the crowd, and our children, with all the other children in the region, are ready with great, huge water pistols and tanks of water brought from home. We have 3 cars full of people and 4 cars full of water tanks, and we drive them to the parade, and the children all set up their sniper points, and they stand there, and they've got towels and chairs, and they sit behind their parents. They're not stupid, and they sit there with... And they wait, and then the fire trucks come. And suddenly from everywhere, they race out from behind the chairs and pump the firemen and throw water-filled balloons, and there's water all over the street. And suddenly, this is the parade for them. If you ask them, what day are we celebrating today? They say, well, it's shooting water at fire truck day, obviously. They love it. The idea of walking in the parade, participating in the parade, is the thing that gets them going. It isn't the floats that are to amaze us or the characters on them. It is our participation every day in the parade that is called for. St. Patrick wrote, I bind unto myself today, by the power of Christ's incarnation, his baptism in the Jordan River, that's a float. His cross of death for my salvation, that's another float in the parade. His bursting from the spiced tomb, another float. his riding up the heavenly way, his coming at the day of doom, all floats. Patrick himself walked in the parade, and we still tell the story of his walk. No snakes, no longer welcome. In Advent, as we wait, we are being thrashed and infected and enlightened by a comfort that moves through strange people in olden days. We see it there. And in our own awakening to it, and in the subsequent actions we dare for its service, all in order to separate us from the killing culture of the empire that presses on us, and to envelop us in the restoring presence of the God who is ever on the way.